famous fictional one is in a story by Edgar Allan Poe. William Wilson, it's called. Jeannie knew about that one, Ralph said. We talked about it. But there have been plenty in real life. Hundreds, it seems like. Including one on the Lusitania. There was a passenger named Rachel Withers in first class, and several people saw another woman who looked just like her, right down to the streak of white in her hair, during the voyage. Some said the double was traveling in steerage. Some said she was part of the staff. Miss Withers and a gentleman friend went looking for her and supposedly spotted her only seconds before a torpedo from a German U-boat hit on the starboard side. Miss Withers died, but her gentleman friend survived. He called her doppelganger a harbinger of doom. The French writer, Guy de Maupassant, met his doppelganger one day while walking on a street in Paris. Same height, same hair, same eyes, same mustache, same accent. Well, the French, Alex said, shrugging. What do you expect? De Maupassant probably bought him a glass of wine. The most famous case happened in 1845 at a girls' school in Latvia. The teacher was writing on the blackboard when her exact double walked into the room, stood beside the teacher, and mimicked her every move, only without the chalk. Then she walked out. 19 students saw it happen. Isn't that amazing? No one replied. Ralph was thinking of an infested cantaloupe and disappearing footprints and something Holly's dead friend had said. No end to the universe. He supposed it was a concept some people might find uplifting, even beautiful. Ralph, a just-the-facts man for his entire working life, found it terrifying. Well, I think it's amazing, Howie said, a bit sulkily. Alex said, Tell me something, Holly. If this guy absorbs his victim's thoughts and memories when he takes their faces through some sort of mystic blood transfusion, I guess, how come he didn't know where to find the nearest walk-in clinic? And then there's Willow Rainwater, the cab driver. Maitland knew her from the kids' basketball program at the Y, but the man she drove to DeBrow acted like he'd never met her. Didn't call her Willow or Ms. Rainwater. Called her ma'am.
I don't know, Holly said rather crossly. All I do know, I picked up on the fly, and I mean that literally because I was on airplanes when I did my reading. The only thing I can do is make guesses, and I'm tired of that.
Maybe it's like speed reading, Ralph said. Speed readers are very proud of being able to go through long books cover to cover in a single sitting, but what they mostly pick up is the general gist. If you question them on the details, they usually come up blank. He paused. At least that's what my wife says. She's in a book club, and there's this one lady who's a little boasty about her reading skills. Drives Jeannie crazy. They watched as the ground crew fueled the King Air and the two pilots did their pre-flight walk around. Holly dragged out her iPad and began to read. Ralph thought she was moving along pretty speedily herself. At 9:45, a Subaru Forester pulled into the tiny Regal parking lot, and Yoon Sablo got out, shrugging a camo knapsack over one shoulder as he talked on his cell phone. He ended his call as he came in.
Amigos! ¿Cómo están?
Fine, Ralph said, standing. Let's get this show on the road.
That was Claude Bolton I was talking to. He's going to meet us at the Plainville Airport. It's about 60 miles from Marysville, where he lives.
Alec raised his eyebrows.
Why would he do that?
He's worried. He says he didn't sleep much last night. Was up and down half a dozen times. Felt like someone was watching the house.
He said it reminded him of days in prison, when everyone knew something was going to go down, but no one knew exactly what, only that it was going to be bad. Said his mother started to get the willies, too. He asked me exactly what was going on, and I told him we'd fill him in when we got there. Ralph turned to Holly. If this outsider exists, and if he was close to Bolton, could Bolton feel his presence?
Instead of protesting again about being asked to guess, she answered in a voice that was soft but very firm. I'm sure of it.
Bienvenidos a Tejas.
July 26th.
1. Jack Hoskins crossed into Texas around 2 a.m. on July 26th and checked into a flea pit called the Indian Motel, just as the day's first light was showing in the east. He paid the sleepy-eyed clerk for a week using his MasterCard, the only one that wasn't maxed out, and asked for a room at the far end of the ramshackle building. The room smelled of used booze and old cigarette smoke. The coverlet was threadbare, and the case of the pillow on the sway-backed bed was yellow with age, sweat, or both. He sat down in the room's only chair and ran quickly and without much interest through the text messages and voicemails on his phone. These latter had ceased around 4 a.m. when the mailbox reached its capacity. All from the station, many from Chief Geller himself. There had been a double murder on the west side. With both Ralph Anderson and Betsy Riggins out of service, he was the only detective on duty. Where was he? He was needed on the scene immediately, blah, blah, blah. He lay down on the bed, first on his back, but that hurt the sunburn too much. He turned onto his side, the spring squalling a protest under his considerable weight. I'll weigh less if the cancer takes hold, he thought. Ma was nothing but a skeleton wrapped in skin by the end. A skeleton that screamed. Not going to happen, he told the empty room. I just need some goddamn sleep. This is going to work out. 4 hours would be enough. 5, if he was lucky. But his brain wouldn't turn off. It was like an engine racing in neutral. Cody, the little dope-pushing rat at the high station, had had the little white pills all right, and he'd also had a good supply of coke, which he claimed was almost pure. From the way Jack felt now, lying on this crappy excuse for a bed, he didn't even consider getting into it. God knew what might be crawling around on the sheets. The claim had been true. A few short snorts were all he'd had in the hours after midnight when it seemed like the drive would never end, and now he felt like he might never sleep again. Felt, in fact, as if he could shingle a roof and then run 5 miles. Yet eventually, sleep did come, although it was thin and haunted by dreams of his mother. When he woke up, it was afternoon, and the room was stinking hot in spite of the poor excuse for an air conditioner. He went into the bathroom, peed, and tried to look at the nape of his throbbing neck. He couldn't. Maybe that was for the best. He went back into the room and sat on the bed to put on his shoes, but he could only find one of them. He groped for the other, and it was pushed into his hand. Jack. He froze, his arms pebbling with goose flesh and the short hairs on the back of his neck lifting. The man who had been in his shower back in Flint City was now under his bed, just like the monsters he had feared as a little boy.
Listen to me, Jack. I'm going to tell you exactly what you need to do.
When the voice finally ceased giving him instructions, Jack realized the pain in his neck, sort of funny, that's what he'd always called the old ball and chain, was gone. Well, almost. And what he was supposed to do seemed straightforward, if kind of drastic. Which was all right, because he was pretty sure he could get away with it, and stopping Anderson's clock would be an absolute pleasure. Anderson was the chief meddler, after all. Old Mr. No Opinion had brought this on himself. He was too bad about the others, but they weren't on Jack. It was Anderson who had dragged him along. Tough titty, said the kitty, he murmured. Once his shoes were on, Jack got down on his knees and looked beneath the bed. There was plenty of dust under there, and some of it looked disturbed, but there was nothing else, which was good, which was a relief. That his visitor had been there, Jack had no doubt, and he had no doubt about what had been tattooed on the fingers that had pushed the shoe into his hand. Can't. With the sunburn pain down to a low mutter and his head relatively clear, he thought he could eat something. Steak and eggs, maybe. He had a piece of work ahead of him, and he had to keep his energy up. Man did not live by blowing pep pills alone. Without food, he might faint in the hot sun, and then he would burn. Speaking of sun, it hit him like a punch in the face when he went out, and his neck gave a warning throb. He realized with dismay that he was out of sunblock and had forgotten his aloe cream. It was possible they sold something like that in the cafe attached to the motel, along with the rest of the rickrack they always kept by the cash register in places like this. T-shirts and ball caps and country CDs and Navajo souvenirs made in Cambodia. They had to sell a few of the necessities along with that crap because the nearest town was... He came to a dead halt, one hand reaching for the cafe's door, peering through the dusty glass. They were in there. Anderson and his merry band of assholes, including the skinny woman with the gray bangs. There was also an old bag in a wheelchair and a muscular man with short black hair and a goatee. The old bag started laughing about something, then she started coughing. Jack could hear it even outside like a damn backhoe in low gear. The man with the goatee whacked her on the back a few times, and then they were all laughing. "You'll be laughing on the other side of your damn faces when I get done with you," Jack thought. But actually it was good they were laughing, otherwise they might have spotted him. He turned away, trying to understand what he had seen. Not the bunch of them hee-hawing, he didn't care about that. But when Goatee Man reached to thump Wheelchair Woman on the back, Jack had seen tats on his fingers. The glass was dusty and the blue ink was faded, but he knew what they said. Can't. How the man had gotten from under his bed and into the diner so fast was a mystery that Jack Hoskins didn't care to contemplate. He had a job to do. That was enough, and getting rid of the cancer that was growing in his skin was only half of it. Getting rid of Ralph Anderson was the other half, and it would be a pleasure. Old Mr. No Opinion.
2. Plainville Airfield sat in scrubland on the outskirts of the tired little city it served. There was a single runway which Ralph thought horribly short. The pilot applied full braking as soon as the wheels touched down and unsecured objects went flying. They came to a stop on a yellow line at the end of the narrow strip of tar, no more than 30 feet from a gully filled with weeds, stagnant water, and shiner cans. "Welcome to nowhere in particular," Alec remarked as the King Air lumbered toward a prefab terminal building that looked as if it might blow away in the next high wind. There was a road-dusty Dodge van waiting for them. Ralph recognized it as the wheelchair-accessible companion model even before he saw the handicap plate. Claude Bolton, tall and muscular in faded jeans, blue work shirt, battered cowboy boots, and a Texas Rangers gimme cap, stood beside him. Ralph was first off the plane, and he extended a hand. After a second of hesitation, Claude shook it. Ralph found it impossible not to look at the faded letters on the man's fingers. Can't.
"Thank you for making this easy," Ralph said. "You didn't have to, and I appreciate it." He introduced the others.
Holly shook his hand last and said, "Those tattoos on your fingers, are they about drinking?"
"Right," Ralph thought. "That's one piece of the puzzle I forgot to take out of the box."
"Yes'm, that's right."
Bolton spoke like someone teaching a well-learned and well-loved lesson. "The big paradox is what they call it in AA meetings down here. I first heard about it in prison. You must drink, but you can't drink."
"I feel that way," about cigarettes, Holly said.
Bolton grinned, and Ralph thought how odd it was that the least socially adept person in their little party was the one who had put Bolton at ease. Not that Bolton had seemed really worried, more on watch.
Yes, ma'am, cigarettes is a hard one. How you doing with it?
Haven't had one in almost a year, Holly said. But I take it a day at a time. Can't and must. I like that.
Had she actually known all along what the finger tattoos meant? Ralph couldn't tell.
Only way to break the can't-must paradox is with the help of a higher power, so I got me one, and I keep my sobriety medallion handy. What I was taught is that if you get wanting a drink, stick that medallion in your mouth. If it melts, you can take one.
Holly smiled, the radiant one Ralph was coming to like so well.
The side door of the van opened, and a rusty ramp squalled out. A large lady with an extravagant corona of white hair rolled down it in a wheelchair. She had a short green oxygen bottle in her lap, with a plastic tube leading from it to the cannula in her nose.
Claude, why are you standing around with these people in the heat? If we're going to roll, we should roll. It's getting on for noon.
This is my mother, Claude said. Ma, this is Detective Anderson, who questioned me on the thing I told you about. These other ones are new to me.
Howie, Alec, and Yoon introduced themselves to the old lady. Holly came last.
It's very nice to meet you, Mrs. Bolton.
Lovey laughed.
Well, we'll see how you feel about that when you get to know me.
I'd better go see about our rental, Howie said. I think it's that one parked by the door. He pointed at a mid-sized dark blue SUV.
I'll lead the way in the van, Claude said. You won't have any problem following along. Not much in the way of traffic on the Marysville Road.
Why don't you ride with us, honey?
Lovey Bolton asked Holly.
Keep an old lady company.
Ralph expected Holly to refuse, but she agreed at once.
Just give me a minute.
She beckoned Ralph with her eyes, and he followed her toward the King Air as Claude watched his mother turn her chair and roll back up the ramp. A small plane was taking off, and at first Ralph couldn't hear what Holly was asking him. He bent closer.
What do I tell them, Ralph? They're sure to ask what we're doing here.
He considered, then said, Why don't you just hit the high spots?
They won't believe me.
That made him grin. Holly, I think you handled disbelief pretty well. 3. Like many ex-cons, at least those that didn't want to risk going back inside, Claude Bolton drove the Dodge Companion van at exactly 5 miles an hour under the speed limit. Half an hour into the trip, he turned in at the Indian Motel and Cafe. He got out and spoke almost apologetically to Howie, who was behind the wheel of the rental.
Hope you don't mind if we have a bite, he said. My ma sometimes has problems if she don't eat regular, and she didn't have any time to make sandwiches. I was afraid we might miss you.
He lowered his voice as if confiding a shameful secret. It's her blood sugar. When it goes low, she gets fainty.
I'm sure we could all use a bite, Howie said.
This story the lady told.
Why don't we talk about it when we get to your house, Claude? Ralph said.
Claude nodded. Yeah, that might be better. The cafe smelled, not unpleasantly, of grease and beans and frying meat. Neil Diamond was on the jukebox singing I Am, I Said in Spanish. The specials, which weren't very, were posted behind the counter. Above the kitchen pass-through was a defaced photograph of Donald Trump. His blonde hair had been colored black. He had been given a forelock and a mustache. Below it, someone had printed, Yankee Veta a Casa. Yankee Go Home. At first, Ralph was surprised. Texas was a red state, after all, as red as they came. But then he remembered that if whites weren't the actual minority this near to the border, it was a close-run thing. They sat at the far end of the room, Alec and Howie at a two-top, the others at a bigger table nearby. Ralph ordered a burger. Holly ordered a salad, which turned out to be mostly wilted iceberg lettuce. Yoon and the Boltons went for the full Mexican, which consisted of a taco, a burrito, and an empanada. The waitress banged a pitcher of sweet tea down on the table without being asked. Lovey Bolton was studying Yoon, her eyes bright as a bird's.
Sablo, you said your name was? That's a funny one.
Yes, not many of us around, Yoon said.
You come from the other side, or are you natural born?
Natural born, ma'am, Yoon said.
Half of his well-stuffed taco disappeared at a single bite.
Second generation.
Well, good for you. Made in the USA. I used to know an Augustine Sablo when I lived way down south before I was married. He drove a bread truck in Laredo and Nuevo Laredo. When he came by the house, my sisters and I used to clamor for churro eclairs. No relation to him, I suppose.
Yoon's olive complexion darkened a bit, not quite a blush, but the look he shot Ralph was amused.
Yes, ma'am, that would have been my poppy.
Well, ain't it a small world, Lovey said and began to laugh. Her laughter turned to coughing, and her coughing turned to choking. Claude thumped her on the back so hard the cannula flew from her nose and fell into her plate. Oh, son, look at that, she said when she had her breath back. Now I got snot on my burrito.
She resettled the cannula.
Well, what the hay? It came from inside me and go right back. No harm done.
She chomped. Ralph began to laugh, and the others joined him. Even Howie and Alec joined in, although they had missed most of the interplay. Ralph had a moment to think how laughter drew people together and was glad Claude had brought his mother along. She was a hot ticket.
Small world,
she repeated.
Yes, it is.
She leaned forward so that her considerable bosom pushed her plate forward. She was still looking at Yoon with those bright bird eyes.
You know the story she told us?
She cut her eyes to Holly, who was picking at her salad with a small frown.
Yes, ma'am.
Ye believe it?
I don't know. Yoon lowered his voice. I tend to.
Lovey nodded and lowered her own voice.
Did you ever see the parade in Nuevo? Proceso dos Pasos? Maybe when you were a boy?
Si, senora.
She lowered her voice further.
What about him? The Farnicoco? You see him?
Si,
Yoon said, and although Lovey Bolton was as white as she could be, Ralph thought Yoon had fallen into Spanish without even thinking of it. She lowered her voice further still.
Give you nightmares?
Yoon hesitated, then said, Sí,
muchas pesadillas.
She leaned back, satisfied but grave. She looked at Claude.
You listen to these folks, sonny. You got a big problem, I think.
She winked at Yoon, but not as a joke. Her face was grave.
Muchos.
4. As the little caravan pulled back out onto the highway, Ralph asked Yoon about the Proceso dos Pasos.
A parade during Holy Week, Yoon said. Not exactly approved by the church, but winked at.
Farnicoco? That's the same as Holly's El Cuco?
Worse, Yoon said. He looked grim. Worse even than the man with the sack. Farnicoco is the hooded man. He's Mr. Death.
5. By the time they got to the Bolton home in Marysville, it was almost 3 o'clock and the heat was like a hammer. They crowded into the small living room where the air conditioner, a noisy window shaker that looked to Ralph old enough for Social Security, did its best to keep up with so many warm bodies. Claude went out to the kitchen and brought back cans of Coke in a styrofoam cooler.
If you were hoping for beer, you're out of luck, he said. I don't keep it.
This is fine, Howie said.
I don't think any of us will be drinking alcohol until we settle this matter to the best of our ability. Tell us about last night."
Bolton glanced at his mother. She folded her arms and nodded.
"Well," he said, "the way it turned out, there really wasn't nothing to it. I went to bed after the late news, like always, and I felt all right then."
"Bull, Pucky," Lovey broke in. "You ain't been yourself since you got here. Restless?"
She looked around at the others.
"Off his feed? Talking in his sleep?"
"Do you want me to tell it, Ma, or do you?"
She flapped a hand for him to go on and sip from her can of Coke.
"Well, she's not wrong," Bolton admitted, "although I wouldn't want the guys back at work to know it. Security staff in a place like Gentleman Please ain't supposed to get all spooked, you know. But I have been, kind of. Only nothing like last night. Last night was different. I woke up around 2, out of a nasty dream, and got up to lock the doors. I never lock 'em when I'm here, although I make Ma do it when she's here alone after her home helpers from Plainville leave at 6.
"What was your dream?" Holly asked. "Can you remember?"
"Somebody under the bed, lying there and looking up. That's all I can remember."
She nodded for him to go on.
"Before I locked the front door, I stepped out on the porch to have a look around, and I noticed all the coyotes had stopped howling. Usually they howl like everything once the moon's up in the sky."
"They do unless someone's around," Alex said. "Then they stop, like the crickets."
"Come think of it, I couldn't hear them either. And Ma's garden out back is usually full of them. I went back to bed but couldn't sleep. I remembered I hadn't locked the windows and got up to do that. The catches squeak, and that woke Ma up. She asked me what I was doing, and I told her to go on back to sleep. I climbed into bed and almost drifted off myself. By then it had to be going on 3. When I remembered, I hadn't locked the window in the bathroom, the one over the tub. I got the idea that someone was climbing in through it, so I got out of bed and ran to see. I know it sounds stupid now, but..."
He looked at them and saw none of them smiling or looking skeptical.
"All right, all right. I guess if you come all the way down here, you probably don't think it sounds stupid. Anyway, I tripped over Ma's damn hassock, and that time she did get up. She asked me if someone was trying to get in the house, and I said no, but for her to stay in her room."
"I didn't, though," Lovey said complacently. "I never minded any man except my husband, and he's been gone a long time."
"There was no one in the bathroom or trying to get in there through the window, but I had a feeling, I can't tell you how strong it was, that he was still out there, hiding and waiting for his chance."
"Not under your bed?" Ralph asked.
"No, I checked under there first thing. Crazy, sure, but..." He paused. "I didn't go to sleep till daybreak. Ma woke me up and said we had to go to the airport so we could meet you."
"Let him sleep as long as I could," Lovey said. "That's why I never made any sandwiches. The bread's on top of the fridge, and if I try to reach up there, I lose my breath."
"And how do you feel now?" Holly asked Claude. He sighed, and when he ran a hand up the side of his face, they could hear the rasp of his beard.
"Not right. I stopped believing in the boogeyman right around the same time I stopped believing in Santa Claus, but I feel all upset and paranoid, the way I did when I was on the coke. Is this guy after me? Do you really believe that?"
He looked from face to face. It was Holly who answered him.
"I do," she said.
6.
They were silent for a bit, thinking. Then Lovey spoke up.
"El Cuco, you called him," she said to Holly.
"Yes."
The old woman nodded, tapping her arthritis-swollen fingers on her oxygen bottle.
"When I was a little girl, the Mex kids called him Cucuy. and the Anglos called him Kooky, or Chooky, or just the Chook. I even had a picture book about that sucker.
I bet I had the same one, Ewan said. My abuela gave it to me. A giant with one big red ear.
See me, amigo.
Lovey took out her cigarettes and lit one. She chuffed out smoke, coughed, and went on.
In the story, there were three sisters. The youngest one cooked and cleaned and did all the other chores. The two older girls were lazy and made fun of her. El Cucuy came. The house was locked, but he looked like their papi, so they let him in. He took the bad sisters to teach them a lesson. He left the good one who worked so hard for the daddy who was raising the girls on his own. Do you remember?
Sure, Ewan said. You don't forget the stories you hear when you're just a kid. That storybook version of El Cucuy was supposed to be a good guy, but all I remember is how scared I was when he dragged the girls up the mountain to his cave. Las niñas lloraban y le rogaban que la soltara. The little girls cried and begged him to let them go.
Yes, Lovey said. And in the end, he did, and those bad girls changed their ways. That's the storybook version. But the real Cucuy don't let the children go, no matter how much they cry and beg. You all know that, don't you? You've seen his work.
So you believe it too, Howie said.
Lovey shrugged.
Like they say, quién sabe? Did I ever believe in El Chupacabra? What the old Los Indios call the goat sucker?
She snorted.
No more than I believe in Bigfoot. But there are strange things, just the same. Once, it was on Good Friday at Blessed Sacrament on Galveston Street. I saw a statue of the Virgin Mary cry tears of blood. We all saw it. Later, Father Joaquin said it was just wet rust from under the eaves running down her face, but we all knew better. Father did, too. You could see it in his eyes.
She swung her gaze back to Holly.
You said you'd seen things yourself.
Yes, Holly said quietly. I believe there's something. It may not be the traditional El Cuco, but is it the thing the legends are based on? I think so.
The boy and those girls you told about, he drank their blood and ate their flesh, this outsider?
He might have, Alex said. Based on the crime scenes, it's possible.
And now he's me, Bolton said. That's what you think. All he needed was some of my blood. Did he drink it? No one answered him, but Ralph could actually see the thing that looked like Terry Maitland doing just that. He could see it with dreadful clarity. That was how far this insanity had gotten into his head. Was that him here last night, skulking around?
Maybe not physically here, Holly said, and he may not be you. Just yet, he might still be becoming you.
Maybe he was checking the place out, Ewan said.
Maybe he was trying to find out about us, Ralph thought. And if he was, he did. Claude knew we were coming.
So what is going to happen now? Lovey demanded. Is he going to kill another kid or two in Plainville or in Austin and try to get my boy blamed for it?
I don't think so, Holly said. I doubt if he's strong enough yet. It was months between Heath Holmes and Terry Maitland, and he's been active.
There's something else, too, Ewan said, a practical aspect. This part of the country's gotten hot for him. If he's smart, and he must be to have survived this long, he'll want to move on.
That felt right. Ralph could see Holly's outsider putting his Claude Bolton face and muscular Claude Bolton body on a bus or a train in Austin and heading into the Golden West.
Las Vegas, maybe, or Los Angeles, where there might be another accidental encounter with a man or even a woman who knew, and a little more blood spilled, another link in the chain. The opening bars of Selena's Baila Esta Cumbia came from Yoon's breast pocket. He looked startled. Claude grinned. Oh, yeah, we got coverage even out here. 21st century, man. Yoon took out his phone, looked at the screen, and said, Montgomery County PD, I better answer this. Excuse me. Holly looked startled, even alarmed, as he took the call and walked out on the porch with, Hello, this is Lieutenant Sablo, trailing after him. Holly excused herself as well and followed him. Howie said, Maybe it's about... Ralph shook his head without knowing why, at least not on the surface of his mind. Where is Montgomery County? Claude asked. Arizona, Ralph said. Before either Howie or Alec could reply, Another matter, nothing to do with this.
What exactly are we going to do about this? Lovey asked. Do you have any idea how to catch this fella? My son is all I got, you know.
Holly came back in. She went to Lovey, bent, whispered in her ear. When Claude leaned over to eavesdrop, Lovey made a shooing gesture.
Go on in the kitchen, son, and bring back those chocolate pinwheel cookies if they ain't melted in the heat.
Claude, obviously trained to mind, went out to the kitchen. Holly continued to whisper, and Lovey's eyes widened. She nodded. Claude came back with the bag of cookies at the same time Yoon came in from the porch, stowing his phone back in his pocket. That was, he began, then stopped. Holly had turned slightly, so her back was to Claude. She raised a finger to her lips and shook her head.
That was nothing, he said. They picked up a guy, but not the one we've been looking for.
Claude put the cookies, which did look sadly melted in their cellophane bag, on the table and glanced around suspiciously.
I don't think that's what you started to say. What's going on here?
Ralph thought that was a good question. Outside on the rural route, a pickup truck trundled by, the lockbox in the bed reflecting bright spears of sun that made him wince.
Son, Lovey said, I want you to get in your car and drive to Tippett and get us some chicken dinners at Highway Heaven. That's a pretty good place. We'll feed these folks, and they can go back to other way and spend a night at the Indian. That ain't much, but it's a roof.
Tippett's 40 miles, Claude protested. Dinners for 7 people will cost a fortune and be dead cold when I get back.
I'll heat everything up on the stove, she said calmly. And those dinners'll be good as new. Go on now.
Ralph liked the way Claude put his hands on his hips and looked at her with humor and exasperation.
You're trying to get rid of me.
That's it, she agreed,
butting her cigarette in a tin ashtray heaped with dead soldiers.
Because if Miss Holly here is right, what you know, he knows. Maybe that don't matter. Maybe all the cats are out of the bag, but maybe it does. So you be a good son and go get those dinners.
Howie took out his wallet.
Allow me to pay, Claude.
That's all right, Claude said a trifle sullenly. I can pay. I ain't broke. Howie smiled his big lawyer smile. But I insist. Claude took the money and tucked it into the wallet chained to his belt. He looked around at his guests, still trying to be sullen, but then he laughed.
My ma usually gets what she wants, he said. I guess you figured that out by now.
7. The Bolton's Byroad, Rural Star Route 2, eventually led to an actual highway, 190 out of Austin. Before it got that far, a dirt road, 4 lanes wide but now falling into disrepair, branched off to the right. It was marked by a billboard which was also falling into disrepair. It depicted a happy family
descending a spiral staircase.
They were holding up gas lanterns that showed their expressions of awe as they peered at the stalactites suspended high above them. The come-on line below the family read, "Visit the Marysville Hole, one of nature's greatest wonders."
Claude knew what it said from the old days when he'd been a restless teenager stuck in Marysville, but in these new days all you could read was, "Visit the Marysv and Atest wonders."
A wide strip reading, "Closed until further notice," itself faded, had been pasted over the rest.
A feeling of lightheadedness came over him as he drove by what local kids called, with knowing sniggers, the road to the hole, but it passed when he kicked the AC up a notch. Although he had protested, he was actually glad to be out of the house. That sense of being watched had faded away. He turned on the radio, tuned to Outlaw Country, got Waylon Jennings, the best, and began to sing along. Chicken dinners from Highway Heaven was maybe not such a bad idea. He could have a whole order of onion rings to himself, eating them on the way home, while they were still hot and greasy.
8.
Jack waited in his room at the Indian Motel, peering out between the drawn drapes, until he saw a van with a handicap plate pulling out onto the road. That had to be the old Bag's ride. A blue SUV followed it, undoubtedly full of the meddlers down from Flint City. When they were out of sight, Jack went up to the cafe where he ate a meal and then inspected the items for sale. There was no aloe cream and no sunblock either, so he bought two bottles of water and a couple of outrageously overpriced bandanas. They wouldn't be much protection from the hot Texas sun, but better than nothing. He got in his truck and drove southwest, in the direction the meddlers had gone, until he came to the billboard and the road leading to the Marysville Hole. Here, he turned in. About 4 miles up, he came to a weather-worn little cabin standing in the middle of the road. It must have been a ticket booth when the hole was a going concern, he supposed. The paint, once bright red, was now the faded pink of blood diluted in water. On the front was a sign reading, "Attraction closed. Turn back here." The road had been chained off beyond the ticket booth. Jack went around the chain, jouncing along the dirt hard pan, crunching tumbleweeds, swerving around sagebrush. The truck took a final bounce, and then he was back on the road, if you could call it that. On this side of the chain, it was your basic mess of weed-choked potholes and washouts that had never been filled in. His Ram, high-sprung and equipped with four-wheel drive, took the washouts easily, spitting dirt and stones from beneath its oversized tires. 2 slow miles and 10 minutes later, he came to an acre or so of empty parking lot. The yellow lines of the spaces faded to ghosts. The asphalt cracked and heaved into plates. To the left, backed up against a steep, brush-covered hill, was an abandoned gift shop with a fallen sign he had to read upside down, "Souvenirs and Authentic Indian Crafts." Straight ahead was the ruin of a wide cement walk leading to an opening in the hill. Well, once upon a time it had been an opening. Now it was boarded over and plastered with signs reading, "Keep out, no trespassing, private property," and "County Sheriff patrols this area." Right, Jack thought. They maybe take a swing through once every February 29th. Another crumbling road led away from the parking lot past the gift shop. It went up one side of a slope and down the other. It took him first to a bunch of decrepit tourist cabins, also boarded up, and then on to some kind of service shed where company vehicles and equipment had probably once been stored. There were more "keep out" signs on this, plus a cheery one that read, "Watch for rattlesnakes." Jack parked his truck in the scant shade of this building. Before getting out, he tied one of the bandanas over his head, giving him a weird resemblance to the man Ralph had seen at the courthouse on the day Terry Maitland was shot. The other he fluffed around his neck to keep that fucking burn from getting worse. He keyed open the lockbox in the truck bed and reverently lifted out the gun case that contained his pride and joy, a Winchester 300 bolt action, the same gun Chris Kyle had used to shoot all those ragheads Jack had seen American Sniper 8 times. With the Leopold VX-1 rifle scope, he could hit a target at 2,000 yards. Well, 4 out of 6 tries on a good day and with no wind, and he didn't expect to be shooting at anywhere near that distance when the time came. If it came. He spotted a few forgotten tools lying in the weeds and appropriated a rusty pitchfork in case of rattlers. Behind the building, a path led up the back of the hill on which the entrance to the hole was located. This side was rockier, not really a hill at all, but an eroded bluff. There were a few beer cans along the way, and several rocks had been tagged with things like Spanky 11 and Doodad was here. Halfway up, another path split off, apparently circling back to the defunct gift shop and the parking lot. Here was a weather-worn, bullet-pocked wooden sign showing an Indian chief in full headdress. Below him was an arrow, the accompanying message so faded it was barely legible. Best pictographs this way. More recently, some wit had drawn a magic marker word balloon coming from the big chief's mouth. It read, Carolyn Allen sucks my red skin cock. This path was broader, but Jack had not come here to admire Native American art, so he continued upward. The climb was not particularly dangerous, but Jack's exercise over the last few years had mostly consisted of bending his elbow in various bars. By the time he was 3/4 of the way up, he was short of breath. His shirt and both bandanas were dark with sweat. He set the gun case and pitchfork down, then bent and gripped his knees until the dark specks dancing in front of his eyes disappeared and his heart rate returned to something like normal. He had come here to avoid a terrible death from the sort of ravenous skin-eating cancer that had taken his mother. Dying of a myocardial infarction while trying to do that would be a bitter joke. He started to straighten up, then paused, squinting. In the shade beneath an overhanging ledge, safe from the worst of the elements, there was more graffiti. But if these had been left by kids, they were long dead, and for many hundreds of years. One showed stick men with stick spears surrounding what might have been an antelope. Something with horns, anyway. In another, stick men were standing in front of what looked like a teepee. In a third, almost too faded to make out, a stick man was standing over the prone body of another stick man, his spear raised in triumph. Pictographs, Jack thought, and not even the best ones according to the big chief back there. Kindergarten kids could do better, but they'll be here long after I'm gone, especially if the cancer gets me. The idea made him angry. He picked up a chunk of sharp rock and hammered at the pictographs until they were obliterated. There, he thought. There you did, fuckers. You're gone and I win. It occurred to him that he might be going crazy, or had already gone. He pushed that away and resumed his climb. When he reached the top of the bluff, he found he had a fine view of the parking lot, the gift shop, and the boarded-up entrance to the Marysville Hole. His visitor with the tats on his fingers wasn't sure the meddlers would come here, but if they did, Jack was to handle them, which he could do with the Winchester, he had no doubt of that. If they didn't come, if they just returned to Flint City after talking to the man they'd come to talk to, Jack's work would be done. Either way, the visitor assured him, Jack would be good as new. No cancer. What if he's lying? What if he can give it, but not take it away? Or what if it's not really there at all? What if he's not there? What if you're just crazy? These thoughts he also pushed away. He opened the gun case, took out the Winchester, and mounted the sight. It put the parking lot and the entrance to the cave right in front of him. If they came, they would be as big as the ticket booth he'd gone around. Jack crawled into the shade of an overhanging rock, first checking for snakes, scorpions, or other wildlife, and had a drink of water, swallowing a couple of pep pills with it. He added a toot from the 4-gram bottle Cody had sold him. No freebies when it came to Colombian marching powder. Now it was just a stakeout, like dozens he'd been on during his career as a cop. He waited, dozing intermittently with the Winchester laid across his lap, but always alert enough to detect movement, until the sun was low in the sky. Then he got to his feet, wincing at the stiffness in his muscles. "Not coming," he said. "At least not today." "No," the man with the finger tattoos agreed, or Jack imagined he agreed. "But you'll be back here tomorrow, won't you?" Indeed he would. For a week, if that was what it took. A month, even. He headed back down, moving carefully. The last thing he needed after hours in the hot sun was a busted ankle. He stowed his rifle in the lockbox, drank some more water from the bottle he'd left in the truck's cab. It was now tepid, going on hot, and drove back to the highway, this time turning toward Tippit, where he might be able to buy some supplies. Sunblock for sure. And vodka. Not too much. He had a responsibility to fulfill, but maybe enough so he could lie down on his crappy, sway-backed bed without thinking about how that shoe had been pushed into his hand. Jesus, why had he ever gone out to that fucking barn in Canning Township? He passed Claude Bolton's car going back the other way. Neither noticed the other. 9.
All right,
Lovey Bolton said when Claude was down the road and out of sight.
What's this all about? What is it you didn't want my boy to hear?
Yoon ignored her for the moment, turning to the others. The Montgomery County Sheriff's Office sent a couple of deputies out to look at the places Holly photographed. They found a pile of bloody clothes in that abandoned factory with the swastika spray painted on the side. One of the items was an orderly's jacket with a tag reading Property of HMU sewn into it.
Heisman Memory Unit, Howie said. When they analyzed the blood on the clothes, what do you want to bet it turns out to be from one or both of the Howard girls?
Plus any fingerprints they find will belong to Heath Holmes, Alec added. They may be blurry if he'd started his change.
Or not, Holly said. We don't know how long the change takes, or even if it's the same every time.
The sheriff up there has questions, Yoon said. I put him off. Considering what we might be dealing with, I hope I can put him off forever.
You folks need to stop talking amongst yourselves and fill me in, Lovey said. Please, I'm worried about my boy. He's as innocent as those other two men, and they are both dead.
I understand your concern, Ralph said. 1 minute. Holly, when you were filling the Boltons in on the ride from the airport, did you tell them about the graveyards? You didn't, did you?
No, just hit the high spots, you said. So that's what I did.
Oh, hold it, Lovey said. Just hold the phone. There was a movie I saw when I was a girl in Laredo. One of those wrestling women movies.
Mexican wrestling women meet the monster, Howie said. We saw it. Ms. Gibney brought a copy. Not Academy Award material, but interesting, just the same.
That was one of the ones Rosita Munoz was in, Lovey said. The Cholita Luchadora. We all wanted to be her, me and my friends. I even dressed up like her one Halloween. My mother made my costume. That movie about the cuckoo was a scary one. There was a professor or a scientist, I don't remember which, but El Cuco took his face. And when the luchadores finally tracked him down, he was living in a crypt or a vault in the local graveyard. Isn't that how the story went?
Yes, Holly said, because that's part of the legend, at least the Spanish version of it. The Cuco sleeps with the dead, like vampires are supposed to do.
If this thing actually exists, Alex said, it is a vampire. At least, sorta. It needs blood to make the next link in the chain, to perpetuate itself.
Once again, Ralph thought, do you people hear yourselves?
He liked Holly Gibney a lot, but he also wished he'd never met her. Thanks to her, there was a war going on in his head, and he wished mightily for a truce.
Holly turned to Lovey.
That empty factory, where the Ohio police found the bloody clothes, is close to the graveyard, where Heath Holmes and his parents are buried. More clothes were found in a barn not far from an old graveyard where some of Terry Maitland's ancestors are buried. So here's the question. Is there a graveyard close to here?
Lovey considered. They waited. At last she said,
there's a boneyard in Plainville, but nothing in Marysville. Hell, we don't even have a church. There used to be one, Our Lady of Forgiveness, but it burned down 20 years ago.
Shit, Howie muttered.
How about a family plot? Holly asked. Sometimes people bury on their property, don't they?
Well, I don't know about other folks, the old lady said, but we never had one. My mama and daddy are buried back in Laredo, and their mama and daddy, too. Way back, it'd be Indiana, which is where my people migrated down from after the Civil War.
What about your husband? Howie asked.
George. All his people were from Austin, and that's where he's buried, right next to his parents. I used to take the bus once in a while to visit him, usually on his birthday. Took flowers and all. But since I got this goddamn COPD, I haven't been.
Well, I guess that's that, Yoon said. Lovey seemed not to hear.
I could sing, you know, back when I still had my wind. And I played guitar. I came to Austin from Laredo after high school because of the music. Nashville South, they call it. I got a job in the paper factory on Brazos Street while I was waiting for my big break at the carousel or the broken spoke or wherever, making envelopes. I never did get my big break, but I married the foreman. That was George. Never regretted it until he retired.
I think we're drifting off the subject, Howie said. Let her talk, Ralph said.
He had that little tingle. The feel of something coming, still over the horizon, but yes, coming.
Go on, Mrs. Bolton. She looked doubtfully at Howie, but when Holly nodded and smiled, Lovey smiled back, lit another cigarette, and went on.
Well, after he got his third in and had his pension, George moved us out here to the back of beyond. Claude was just 12. We had him late. Long after we decided God wasn't going to give us no children. Claude never liked Marysville. Missed the bright lights and his worthless friends. Bad company was always my boy's downfall, and I didn't care for it much either at first, although I have come to enjoy the peace of it. When you get old, peace is about all you want. You folks might not believe that now, but you'll find out. And that idea of a family plot ain't such a bad one, now I think of it. I could do worse than going into the ground out back, but I suppose Claude will end up dragging my meat and bones to Austin so I can lay with my husband like I did in life. Won't be long now, neither.
She coughed, looked at her cigarette with distaste, and buried it with the others in the overfilled ashtray where it smoldered balefully.
You know why we happened to end up in Marysville? George had the idea, he was going to raise alpacas. After they died, which didn't take long, it was going to be golden doodles. If you don't know, golden doodles are a cross between golden retrievers and poodles. You think evolution ever approved of a mix like that? I goddamn doubt it. His brother put the notion in his head. No greater fool than Roger Bolton ever walked the earth, but George thought their fortunes was made. Roger moved down here with his family, and the two of them went partners. Anyway, the golden doodle pups died just like the alpacas. George and me were a little tight for money after that, but we had enough to get by. Roger, though, he poured his whole savings into that damn fool scheme, so he looked around for work and...
She stopped, an expression of amazement dawning on her face. "What about Roger?" Ralph asked.
"Damn," Lovey Bolton said. "I'm old, but that's no excuse. It was right in front of my face."
Ralph leaned forward and took one of her hands. "What are you talking about, Lovey?" Going to her first name, as he always eventually did in the interrogation room.
"Roger Bolton and his two sons, Claude's cousins, are buried not 4 miles from here, along with 4 other men. Or maybe 5. And those children, of course. Them twins."
She shook her head slowly back and forth.
"I was so mad when Claude got 6 months in Gatesville for stealing. And ashamed. That's when he started using drugs, you know. But I saw later it was God's mercy, because if he'd been here, he would have been with them. Not his dad. By then, George had already had 2 heart attacks and couldn't go. But Claude, yes, he would have been with them."
"Where?" Alec asked. He was leaning forward now, staring intently.
"The Marysville Hole," she said. "That's where those men died, and that's where they remain."
10. She told them it had been like the part in Tom Sawyer when Tom and Becky get lost in the cave, only Tom and Becky eventually got out. The Jameson twins, just 11 years old, never did, nor did those who tried to rescue them. The Marysville Hole took them all. "That's where your brother-in-law got work after the dog business failed?" Ralph asked. She nodded.
"He'd done some exploring there, not in the public part, but on the Ahiga side. So when he applied, they hired him on as a guide quick as winking. Him and the other guides used to take tourists down in groups of 12 or so. It's the biggest cave in all of Texas, but the most popular part, what folks really wanted to see, was the main chamber. It was quite a place, all right. Like a cathedral. They called it the Chamber of Sound because of the, what do you call them, acoustics. One of the guides would stand at the bottom, 400 or 500 feet down, and whisper the Pledge of Allegiance, and the people at the top would hear every word. Echoes seemed to go on forever. Also, the walls were covered with Indian drawings. I forget the word for them."
"Pictographs," Yoon said.
"That's it. You got a Coleman gas lamp when you went in so you could look at them or up at the stalactites hanging down from the ceiling. There was an iron spiral staircase that went all the way to the bottom, 400 steps or more, around and around and around. It's still there, I shouldn't wonder, although I wouldn't trust it these days. It's damp down there. And iron rusts. Only time I took them stairs, it made me dizzy as hell, and I wasn't even looking up at the stalactites like most of them. You won't believe I took that elevator back to the top. Going down is one thing, but only a pure D fool climbs up 400 steps if she don't have to. The bottom was 200, maybe 300 yards across. There were colored lights set up to show off all the mineral streaks in the rocks. There was a snack bar, and there were 6 or 8 passageways to explore. They had names. Can't recall all of them, but there was the Navajo Art Gallery, where there were more pictographs, and the Devil's Slide and Snake's Belly, where you had to bend over and even crawl in places. Can you imagine?
Yes, Holly said. Oof.
Those were the main ones. There were even more leading off from them, but they were closed off because the hole isn't just one cave, but dozens of them going down and down, some never explored.
Easy to get lost, Alex said.
You bet. Now here's what happened. There were 2 or 3 openings leading away from the Snake's Belly passageway that weren't boarded over or barred up, because they were considered too small to bother with.
Only they weren't too small for the twins, Ralph guessed.
That's the nail, sir, and you hit it on the head. Carl and Calvin Jameson. Couple of pint-sizers looking for trouble, and they sure found it. They were with the party that went into Snake's Belly, right behind their ma and pa at the end of the line, but not with them when they came out. The parents, well, I don't have to tell you how they took on, do I? My brother-in-law wasn't the one leading the group the Jameson family was a part of, but he was in the search party that went after them. Headed it up would be my guess, although I have no way of knowing.
His sons were also part of it? Howie asked. Claude's cousins?
Yes, sir. The boys worked part-time at the hole themselves and came on the run as soon as they heard. Lots of folks came because the news spread like wildfire. At first it looked like it wasn't going to be no problem. They could hear the boys calling from all the openings leading off from the Snake's Belly, and they knew exactly which one they went into, because when one of the guides shone his flashlight, they could see a little plastic Chief Ahiga Mr. Jameson bought one of the boys in the gift shop. Must have fallen out of his pocket while he was crawling. As I say, they could hear him yelling, but couldn't none of the grown-ups fit in that hole. Couldn't even reach the toy. They hollered for the boys to come to the sound of their voices, and if there wasn't room to turn around, to just back up. They shone their lights in and waved them around, and at first it sounded like the kids were getting closer. But then their voices started to fade, and faded some more, until finally they were gone. You ask me? They were never close to begin with.
Tricky acoustics, Yoon said.
Si, senor. So then Roger said they should go around to the Ahiga side, which he knew pretty well from his exploring, what they call spelunking. Once they got there, they heard those boys again, clear as day, crying and yelling. So they got rope and lights from the equipment building and went in to fetch them out. Seemed like the right thing, but it was the end of them instead.
What happened? Yoon asked. Do you know? Does anybody?
Well, like I told you, that place is a goddamn maze. They left one man behind to pay out rope and tie on more in case they needed it. That was Ev Brinkley. He left town shortly after. Went to Austin. Broken-hearted, he was. But at least alive and able to walk in the sunlight. Those others,
Lovey sighed.
No more sunlight for them.
Ralph thought about that. The horror of it. And saw what he felt on the faces of the others.
Ev was down to his last 100 feet of free rope when he heard something he said sounded like a cherry bomb a kid set off in a toilet bowl with the lid shut. What must have happened is some goddamn fool fired a pistol hoping to lead the boys to the rescue party, and there was a cave-in. It wasn't Roger done that. I'd bet $1,000 it wasn't. Old Rog was a fool about many things, especially those dogs, but never fool enough to fire a gun in a cave. where the ricochet could go anywhere.
Or where the sound could bring down a piece of ceiling, Alex said. Must have been like firing a shotgun to start an avalanche up in the high country.
So they were crushed, Ralph said.
Lovey sighed and resettled her cannula, which had come askew.
Nope. Might have been better if they were. At least it would have been quick. But people in the big cavern, the Chamber of Sound, could hear 'em calling for help, just like those lost lads. By then, there were 60 or 70 men and women out there, eager to do whatever they could. My George had to be there. His brother and his nephews were among those trapped after all, and finally I gave up on keeping him home. I went with him to make sure he didn't try to do some damn fool thing like trying to pitch in. That would have killed him for sure.
And when this accident happened, Ralph said, Claude was in the reformatory?
Gatesville Training School is what I believe they called it, but yes, a reformatory is what it was.
Holly had produced a yellow legal pad from her carry bag and was bent over it, taking notes.
By the time I got to the hole with George, it was dark. The parking lot's a good size, but it was damn near full. They'd set up big lights on posts, and with all the trucks and people scurrying around, it was like they were making a Hollywood movie. They went in through the Higa entrance carrying 10-cell flashlights, wearing hard hats and puffy coats like flak jackets. They followed the rope to the cave-in. A long way, some of it through standing water. The rockfall was pretty bad. Took 'em all that night and half the next morning to clear it enough to get past. By then, people in the big cave couldn't hear the lost ones calling no more.
Your brother-in-law's bunch wasn't waiting for rescue on the other side, I take it, Yoon said.
No, they were gone. Roger or one of the others might have thought he knew a way back to the big cave, or they might have been afraid more of the ceiling was going to cave in. No way to tell. But they left a trail, at least to start with. Marks on the walls and litter on the floor, coins and screws of paper. One man even left his bowling card from the Tippett Lanes. One more punch, and he'd have got himself a free string. That was in the paper.
Like Hansel and Gretel, leaving breadcrumbs behind, Alec mused.
Then everything just stopped, Lovey said. Right in the middle of a gallery. The marks, the dropped coins, the balls of paper, just stopped.
Like the footprints in Bill Samuel's story, Ralph thought.
The second rescue party kept going for a while, calling and waving their flashlights, but no one called back. The fellow who wrote it up for the Austin paper interviewed a bunch of those guys from the second rescue party later on, and they all said the same thing. There were just too many paths to choose from, all of 'em going down, some leading to dead ends and some to chimneys as dark as wells. They weren't supposed to holler for fear of starting another cave-in, but then one of them yelled anyway, and sure enough, a piece of the roof come down. That's when they decided they better get the hell out.
Surely they didn't abandon the search after one try, Howie said.
No, course not.
She fished another Coke out of the cooler, cracked it, and swallowed half at a go.
Not used to talking so much, and I'm parched.
She checked her oxygen bottle.
Almost out of this stuff, too, but there's another one in the bathroom there with the rest of my goddamn medical supplies if someone wants to fetch it.
Alec Pelly took charge of this task, and Ralph was relieved when the woman didn't attempt to light up as he swapped them out. Once the oxygen was flowing again, she resumed her story.
There was a dozen search parties went in there over the years, right up until the ground shaker in 07. After that, it was considered too dangerous. It was only a 3 or 4 on the Richter, but caves are fragile, you know. The Chamber of Sound stood up to it pretty well, although a bunch of the stalactites fell off the ceiling. Some of the other passages, though, collapsed. I know the one they called the Art Gallery did. Since the Shaker, Marysville Hole has been closed. The main entrance is stopped up, and I believe Ahiga is too.
For a moment, no one spoke. Ralph didn't know about the others, but he was thinking of what it must have been like to die a slow death deep underground in the dark. He didn't want to think about it and couldn't help it. Lovey said,
"You know what Roger said to me once? Couldn't have been 6 months before he died. He said the Marysville Hole might go all the way down to hell. And that makes it a place where this outsider of yours would feel right at home, don't you think?"
"Not a word about this when Claude comes back," Holly said.
"Oh, he knows," Lovey said. "Those were his people. He didn't care for his cousins much. They were older and used to bully-rag him something awful. But they were still his people."
Holly smiled, but not the radiant one. It didn't touch her eyes. "I'm sure he does. But he doesn't know. We know. And that's the way it has to stay."
11. Lovey, now looking tired going on exhausted, said the kitchen was too small for 7 people to eat in comfortably, so they'd have to take their meal out back in what she called the gaze bowl. She told them, proudly, that Claude had built it for her himself with a kit he got at the Home Depot.
"It might be a little hot at first, but a breeze usually sets in this time of day and it's screened against the bugs."
Holly suggested that the old lady should take a lie down and let the company set up for supper outside.
"But you won't know where anything is."
"Don't worry about that," Holly said. "Finding things is what I do for a living, you know. And these gentlemen will help out, I'm sure." Lovey gave in and wheeled along to her bedroom, where they heard her grunting effortfully, followed by the squall of bedsprings. Ralph stepped out on the front porch to call Jeannie, who answered on the first ring. "E.T. phone home," she said cheerfully. "Everything quiet there?"
"Except for the TV. Officers Ramage and Yates have been watching NASCAR. I only surmise bets were made, but know for sure they ate all the brownies."
"Sorry to hear that." "Oh, and Betsy Riggins came by to show off her new baby. I'd never say this to her, but he looks quite a bit like Winston Churchill."
"Uh-huh. Listen, I think either Troy or Tom should stay the night."
"I was thinking both. In with me. We can cuddle. Perhaps even canoodle."
"What a good idea. Be sure to take some pictures."
A car was approaching. Claude Bolton, back from Tippett with their chicken dinners.
"Don't forget to lock up and set the burglar alarm."
The locks and alarm didn't help the other night.
"Humor me and do it anyway."
The man who looked exactly like his wife's nighttime visitor was at that moment getting out of his car, and seeing him gave Ralph a queer feeling of double vision. "All right. Have you found anything out?"
"Hard to tell." This was skirting the truth. Ralph thought they had found out a great deal, none of it good. "I'll try to call you later on, but right now I have to go."
"Okay. Stay safe."
"I will. Love you."
"Love you too. And I mean it. Stay safe."
He went down the porch steps to help Claude with 6 plastic bags from Highway Heaven. "Food's cold, just like I said, but does she listen? Never did, never will. We'll be fine. Reheated chicken's always tough. I got the mashed potatoes because reheated French fries, forget it."
They started toward the house. Claude stopped at the foot of the porch steps.
"Did you guys have a good talk with Mama?"
"We did," Ralph said, wondering exactly how to handle this. As it turned out, Claude handled it for him.
"Don't tell me. That guy might be able to read my mind."
"So you believe in him?" Ralph was honestly curious.
"I believe that gal believes, that Holly, and I believe there might have been someone around last night. So whatever you talked about, I don't want to hear."
Maybe that's for the best. But, Claude, I think one of us should stay here with you and your mother tonight. I was thinking Lieutenant Sablo could do that. You expecting trouble? Because I don't feel anything just now except hungry.
Not trouble, exactly, Ralph said. I was just thinking that if something bad happened around here, and if there happened to be a witness who said the person who did it looked a lot like Claude Bolton, you might like to have a cop handy who could testify that you never left your mama's house.
Claude considered. That might not be such a bad idea. Only we don't have a guest room or anything. The couch makes into a bed, but sometimes Ma gets up when she can't get back to sleep and goes out to the living room to watch TV. She likes those worthless preachers that are always yelling for love offerings. He brightened. But there's a spare mattress out in the back entry, and it's going to be a warm night. I guess he could camp out.
In the gazebo?
Claude grinned.
Right. I built that sucker myself.
12. Holly put the chicken under the broiler for 5 minutes, and it crisped up nicely. The seven of them ate in the gazebo. There was a ramp for Lovey's wheelchair, and the conversation was both pleasant and lively. Claude turned out to be quite the raconteur, telling tales about his colorful career as a security official at Gentleman Please. The stories were funny, but neither mean nor off-color, and no one laughed harder at them than Claude's mother. She laughed herself into another coughing fit when Howie told the story of how one of his clients, in an effort to prove he was mentally unfit to stand trial, had taken his pants off in court and waved them at the judge. The reason for their trip to Marysville was never touched upon. Lovey's lie-down before dinner had been a short one, and when the meal was done, she announced that she was going back to bed.
"Not many dishes with takeout," she said, "and what there is I can wash in the morning. I can do it right from my chair, you know, although I have to be careful of the goddamn oxygen tank."
She turned to Yoon.
"You sure you gonna be all right out here, Officer Sablo? What if someone comes stirring around like last night?"
"I'm fully armed, ma'am," Yoon said, "and this is a very nice place out here."
"Well, you come on in any time. Wind might kick up strong after midnight. Back door be locked, but the key's under that olla de barro."
She pointed at the old clay pot, then crossed her hands above her admirable bosom and did a little bow.
"You are fine folks, and I thank you for coming here and trying to do right by my boy."
With that, she rolled away. The six of them sat a little longer.
"That's a good woman," Alex said.
"Yes," Holly said. "She is."
Claude lit a Tipperillo.
"Cops on my side," he said. "That's a new experience. I like it."
Holly said, "Is there a Walmart in Plainville, Mr. Bolton? I need to do some shopping, and I love Walmarts."
"Nope, and a good thing, because Ma does too, and I'd never get her out of it. Closest thing to it we got in these parts is the Home Depot in Tippett."
"That should do," she said, and stood up. "We'll clean those dishes so Lovey doesn't have to in the morning, and then we'll be on our way. We'll be back tomorrow to pick up Lieutenant Sablo, then leave for home. I think we've done all we can do here. Do you agree, Ralph?"
Her eyes told him what to say, and he said it.
"Sure."
"Mr. Gold, Mr. Pelly?"
"I think we're fine," Howie said. Alec went along. "Pretty well done here."
13. Although they returned to the house only 15 minutes or so after Lovey had taken her leave, they could already hear rough snores coming from her bedroom. Yoon filled the sink with suds, rolled up his sleeves, and began to wash the few things they had used. Ralph dried, Holly put away. The evening light was still strong, and Claude was out back with Howie and Alec, touring the property and looking for any signs of the previous night's intruder, if there had been one.
"I'd have been all right even if I'd left my sidearm home," Yoon said.
I had to go through Mrs. Bolden's bedroom to get into her bathroom where she keeps her oxygen, and she's well gunned up. Got a Ruger American 10 plus 1 on the dresser, extra clip right beside it, and a Remington 12 gauge leaning in the corner right next to her Electrolux. Don't know what old Claudie's got, but I'm sure he's got something.
Isn't he a convicted felon? Holly asked.
He is, Ralph agreed, but this is Texas, and he seems rehabilitated to me.
Yes, she said. He does, doesn't he?
I think so, too, Yoon said. Seems like he's turned his life around. I've seen it before when people get into AA or NA. When it works, it's like a miracle. Still, this outsider couldn't have picked a better face to hide behind, wouldn't you say? Given his history of drug sales and service, not to mention a gang background with Satan 7, who'd believe him if he said he was being framed for something? No one believed Terry Maitland, Ralph said heavily, and Terry was immaculate.
14. It was dusk when they got to the Home Depot, and after 9 o'clock when they arrived back at the Indian Motel, observed by Jack Hoskins, once more peering through the drapes in his room and rubbing obsessively at the back of his neck. They carried their purchases into Ralph's room and laid them out on the bed, 5 short-barreled UV flashlights with extra batteries, and 5 yellow hard hats. Howie picked up one of the flashlights and winced at the bright purple glare.
This thing will really pick up his trail? His spore?
It will, if it's there, Holly said.
Huh. Howie dropped the flashlight back on the bed, put on one of the hard hats, and went to the mirror over the dresser to inspect himself. I look ridiculous, he said.
No one disagreed.
We're really going to do this? Try to, at least? That's not a rhetorical question, by the way. It's me trying to get my head around it as an actual fact.
I think we'd have a hard job convincing the Texas Highway Patrol to pitch in, Alex said mildly. What exactly would we tell them? That we think there's a monster hiding in the Marysville hole?
If we don't do it, Holly said, he'll kill more children. It's how he lives.
Howie turned to her, almost accusingly.
How are we going to get in? The old lady said it's buttoned up tighter than a nun's underwear. And even if we do, where's the rope? Doesn't Home Depot sell rope? They must sell rope.
We shouldn't need any, she said quietly. If he's in there, and I'm almost sure he is, he won't have gone deep. For one thing, he'd be afraid of getting lost himself, or of being caught in a cave-in. For another, I think he's weak. He should be in the hibernation part of his cycle. But instead, he's been exerting himself.
By projecting? Ralph asked. That's what you believe?
Yes. What Grace Maitland saw, what your wife saw, I believe those were projections. I think a small part of his physical self was there. That's why there were traces in your living room, why he could move the chair and turn on the stove light, but not even enough to leave impressions on the new carpet. Doing that has to tire him out. I think he might have shown up wholly in the flesh only a single time, at the courthouse on the day Terry Maitland was shot, because he was hungry and knew there would be a lot to eat.
He was there in the flesh, but didn't show up on any of the TV videotape? Howie asked. Like a vampire who doesn't cast a reflection in mirrors.
He spoke as if expecting her to deny this, but she didn't.
Exactly.
Then you think he's supernatural? A supernatural being?
I don't know what he is.
Howie took off the hard hat and tossed it onto the bed.
Guesswork. That's all you've got.
Holly looked wounded by this, and at a loss for how to reply. Nor did she seem to realize what Ralph saw, and was sure Alex saw as well.
Howard Gold was frightened. If this thing went sideways, there was no judge to whom he could object. He could not ask for a mistrial.
Ralph said.
It's still hard for me to accept all this stuff about El Cuco or shapeshifters. But there was an outsider. That I do accept now. Because of the Ohio connection and because Terry Maitland simply couldn't have been in two places at the same time.
The outsider screwed up there, Alex said. He didn't know Terry was going to be at that convention in Cap City. Most of his chosen scapegoats would be like Heath Holmes with alibis like cheesecloth.
That doesn't follow, Ralph said. Alec raised his eyebrows. If he got Terry's, I don't know how to say it, memories, sure, but not just memories, a sort of
terrain map of his consciousness, Holly said quietly.
Okay, call it that, Ralph said. I can accept that there's stuff he could have missed, the way speed readers miss stuff while they're zipping along, but that convention would have been a big deal to Terry.
Then why would the Cuco still...
Alec began.
Maybe he had to. Holly had picked up one of the UV flashlights and was shining it on the wall, where it picked up a ghostly handprint from some previous resident.
It was a thing Ralph could have done without seeing.
Maybe he was too hungry to wait for a better time.
Or maybe he didn't care, Ralph said. Serials often get to that point, usually just before they get caught. Bundy, Speck, Gacy. Eventually they all started to believe they were a law unto themselves. Godlike. They got arrogant and overreached. And this outsider didn't overreach by all that much, did he? Think about it. We were going to arraign Terry and see him put on trial for the murder of Frank Peterson in spite of everything we knew. We were sure his alibi had to be bogus, no matter how strong it was. And part of me still wants to believe that. The alternative turns everything I thought I understood about the world I live in upside down. He felt feverish and a little sick to his stomach. How could a normal man in the 21st century accept a shape-shifting monster? If you believed in Holly Gibney's outsider, her El Cuco, then everything was on the table. No end to the universe.
He's not arrogant anymore, Holly said quietly. He's used to staying in one place for months after he kills and while he makes his change. He only moves on when that change is complete or nearly complete. That's what I believe, based on what I've read and what I learned in Ohio. But his usual pattern has been disrupted. He had to run from Flint City once that boy discovered he'd been staying in their barn. He knew the police would come, so he came down here early to be near Claude Bolton, and he found a perfect home.
The Marysville Hole, Alex said.
Holly nodded. But he doesn't know. We know. That's our advantage. Claude knows his uncle and cousins are buried there, yes. What Claude doesn't know is how the outsider hibernates in or near places of the dead, preferably those associated with the bloodline of the person he's changing into or out of. I'm sure it works that way. It must.
Because you want it to, Ralph thought. Yet he couldn't find any holes in her logic. If that was you accepted the basic postulate of a supernatural being that had to follow certain rules, possibly out of tradition, possibly out of some unknown imperative none of them would ever be able to understand.
Can we be sure Lovey won't tell him? Alec asked.
I think so, Ralph said. She'll keep quiet for his own good.
Howie took one of the flashlights and shone it at the rattling air conditioner, this time picking up a litter of spectrally glowing fingerprints.
He snapped it off and said, What if he has a helper? Tell me that.
Count Dracula had that guy Renfield. Dr. Frankenstein had a hunchback guy, Igor.
Holly said, That's a popular misconception. In the original Frankenstein movie, the doctor's assistant was actually named Fritz, played by Dwight Fry. Later, Bela Lugosi...
I stand corrected, Howie said, but the question remains.
What if our outsider has an accomplice, somebody with orders to keep tabs on us? Doesn't that make sense? Even if the outsider doesn't know we found out about the Marysville hole, he knows we're too close for comfort.
I see your point, Howie, Alex said. But serials are usually loners, and the ones who stay free the longest are drifters. There are exceptions, but I don't think our guy is one of them. He hopped down to Flint City from Dayton. If you back-trailed him from Ohio, you might find murdered children in Tampa, Florida, or Portland, Maine. There's an African proverb, he travels fastest who travels alone. And practically speaking, who could he hire for a job like that?
A nut, Howie said.
Okay, Ralph said, but from where? Did he just stop by Nuts R Us and pick one up?
Fine, Howie said. He's on his own, just cowering in the Marysville hole and waiting for us to come and get him, drag him into the sun, or put a stake in his heart, or both.
In Stoker's novel, Holly said, they cut off Dracula's head when they caught him and stuffed his mouth full of garlic.
Howie tossed the flashlight on the bed and threw up his hands. Also fine. We'll stop by Shopwell and buy some garlic. Also a meat cleaver, since we neglected to buy a hacksaw while we were in Home Depot.
Ralph said, I think a bullet in the head should do the trick nicely.
They considered this in silence for a moment, and then Howie said he was going to bed.
But before I do, I'd like to know what the plan is for tomorrow.
Ralph waited for Holly to enlighten Howie on this point, but she looked at Ralph instead. He was startled and moved by the hollows under her eyes and the lines that had appeared at the corners of her mouth. Ralph himself was tired. He supposed they all were. But Holly Gibney was exhausted, at this point running on nothing but nerves. And given her tightly wrapped persona, he guessed that for her that would be like running on thorns or broken glass.
Nothing before 9 o'clock, Ralph said. We all need at least 8 hours of sleep, more if we can get it. Then we pack up, check out, go to the Boltons, and pick up Yoon. From there to the Marysville hole.
Wrong direction if we want Claude to think we're flying home, Alex said. He'll wonder why we aren't headed back to Plainville.
Okay, we tell Claude and Lovey we have to go to Tippett first because...
I don't know. We have some more shopping to do at Home Depot.
Pretty thin, Howie said.
Alec asked, who was the state cop who came out to talk to Claude? Do you remember?
Ralph didn't offhand, but he had kept case notes on his iPad. Routine was routine, even when chasing the boogeyman.
His name was Owen Sipe, Corporal Owen Sipe.
Okay, you tell Claude and his mama, which is the same thing as telling the outsider if he really can get inside Claude's head, that you got a call from Corporal Sipe saying that a man roughly matching Claude's description is wanted in Tippett for questioning in a robbery or a car theft or maybe a home invasion. Yoon can verify that Claude was at home all night.
Not if he was sleeping out in the gazebo, Ralph said.
You tell me you wouldn't have heard Claude start his car? That thing needed a new muffler 2 years ago.
Ralph smiled. Point taken.
Okay, so you say we're going to Tippett to check it out, and if it leads nowhere, we're going to fly back to Flint City. Sound okay?
Sounds fine, Ralph said. Just let's be damn sure Claude doesn't see the flashlights and hard hats.
15. As 11 o'clock came and went, Ralph was lying on the sway-backed bed in his room, knowing he should turn out the light and not doing it. He had called Jeannie and gabbed with her for almost half an hour, some of it about the case, some of it about Derek, most of it inconsequential shit. After that, he tried the TV, thinking one of Lovey Bolton's late-night preachers might work as a sleeping pill, or at least quiet the constant rat-run of his thoughts. But all he got when he turned it on was a message saying
Our satellite is currently down. Thank you for your patience. He was reaching for the lamp when a light knock came at the door. He crossed the room, reached for the knob, thought better of it, and tried the peephole. It turned out to be useless, clogged with dirt or something.
Who is it?
Me, Holly said. Her voice was as small as her knock. He opened the door. Her T-shirt was untucked, and the coat of her suit, which she had put on against the late-night chill, hung down comically on one side. Her short gray hair flew in the rising wind. She was holding her iPad. Ralph suddenly realized he was in his boxers with the buttonless fly no doubt gaping slightly. He remembered something they used to say when they were kids. Who gave you a license to sell hot dogs?
I woke you up, she said.
You didn't. Come in. She hesitated, then stepped into the room and sat in the single chair while he put on his pants.
You need to get some sleep, Holly. You look very tired.
I am. But sometimes it seems as if the more tired I am, the harder it is to go to sleep, especially if I'm worried and anxious.
Tried Ambien?
It's not recommended for people taking antidepressants.
I see.
I did some research. Sometimes that puts me to sleep. I started by looking up the newspaper stories concerning the tragedy Claude's mother told us about. There was a lot of coverage and a lot of background. I thought you might like to hear.
Will it help us?
I think it will.
Then I want to hear.
He moved to the bed, and Holly perched on the edge of the chair, knees together. All right. Lovey kept talking about the Ahiga side, and she said one of the Jameson twins dropped a plastic Chief Ahiga out of his pocket. She opened her iPad. This was taken in 1888. The sepia-toned photograph showed a noble-looking Native American man in profile. He was wearing a headdress that flowed halfway down his back. For a while, the chief lived with a small contingent of Navajos on the Tigua Reservation near El Paso, then married a Caucasian woman and moved first to Austin, where he was treated badly, and then to Marysville, where he was accepted as a member of the community after cutting his hair and professing his Christian faith. His wife had a little money, and they opened the Marysville Trading Post, which eventually became the Indian Motel and Cafe.
Home sweet home, Ralph said, looking around at the shabby room.
Yes, here is Chief Ahiga in 1926, 2 years before he died. By then, he'd changed his name to Thomas Higgins. She showed him a second picture.
Holy shit, Ralph exclaimed. I'd say he went native, but this is more like the opposite.
It was the same noble profile, but now the cheek facing the camera was deeply scored with wrinkles, and the headdress was gone. The former Navajo chieftain was wearing rimless spectacles, a white shirt, and a tie. Holly said, in addition to running Marysville's only successful business, it was Chief Ahiga, a.k.a. Thomas Higgins, who discovered the hole and ran the first tours. They were quite popular.
But the cave was named for the town instead of for him, Ralph said. Which figures. He may have been a Christian and a successful businessman, but he remained a redskin to the community. Still, I guess the locals treated him better than the Christians in Austin. Got to give them some credit for that. Go on.
She showed him another picture. This one was of a wooden sign with a painted version of Chief Ahiga in his headdress and a legend beneath reading, "Best Pictographs This Way." She used her fingers to zoom out, and Ralph could see a path leading through the rocks. The cave has the town's name, she said, but at least the chief got something. The Ahiga entrance
much less glamorous than the Chamber of Sound, but with a direct connection to it. A higas, where the staff brought in supplies, and it was a way out in case of an emergency.
That's where the rescue parties went in, hoping to find an alternate route that would take them to the kids?
Correct. She leaned forward, eyes shining. The main entrance isn't just boarded up, Ralph. It's cemented over. They didn't want to lose any more kids. The Ahiga entrance, the back door, was also boarded up, but none of the articles I read said anything about it being plugged with cement.
That doesn't mean it wasn't.
She gave her head an impatient toss. I know, but if it wasn't,
then that's how he got in. The outsider. That's what you believe.
We should go there first, and if there are signs of a break-in.
I get it, he said, and it sounds like a plan. Good going. You're a hell of a detective, Holly.
She thanked him, with her eyes lowered, and in the tentative voice of a woman who doesn't know quite what to do with compliments. You're kind to say that.
It's not kindness. You're better than Betsy Riggins, and much better than the waste of space known as Jack Hoskins. He'll be retiring soon, and if the job was mine to give, you'd get it.
Holly shook her head, but she was smiling. Bail jumpers, repos, and lost dogs are enough for me. I never want to be part of another murder investigation.
He stood up. Time for you to go back to your room and get some shut-eye. If you're right about any of this, tomorrow's going to be a John Wayne day.
In a minute, I had another reason for coming here. You better sit down. 16. Even though she was a much stronger person than she had been on the day she'd had the great good fortune to meet Bill Hodges, Holly was not used to telling people they had to change their behavior or that they were flat out wrong. That younger woman had been a terrified, scurrying mouse who sometimes thought suicide might be the best solution for her feelings of terror, inadequacy, and free-floating shame. What she felt most of all on the day when Bill had sat down next to her behind a funeral parlor she could not bring herself to enter, was the sense that she had lost something vital. Not just a purse or a credit card, but the life she could have led if things had been just a little different, or if God had seen fit to put just a little more of some important chemical in her system.
I think you lost this, Bill had said,
without ever actually saying it.
Here, better put it back in your pocket.
Now Bill was dead, and here was this man, so like Bill in many ways. His intelligence, his occasional flashes of good humor, and most of all, his doggedness. She was sure Bill would have liked him, because Detective Ralph Anderson also believed in chasing the case. But there were differences, too, and not just that he was 30 years younger than Bill had been when he died, that Ralph had made a terrible mistake in arresting Terry Maitland in public before he understood the true dimensions of the case was only one of those differences, and probably not the most important, no matter how it haunted him. God, help me to tell him what I need to tell him, because this is the only chance I'll have. And let him hear me. Please, God, let him hear me. She said, every time you and the others talk about the outsider, it's conditional.
I'm not sure I understand you, Holly.
I think you do. If he exists, supposing he exists, assuming he exists. Ralph was silent. I don't care about the others, but I need you to believe, Ralph. I need you to. to believe. I do, but I'm not enough.
Holly?
No, she said fiercely. No, listen to me. I know it's crazy, but is the idea of El Cuco any more inexplicable than some of the terrible things that happen in the world? Not natural disasters or accidents. I'm talking about the things some people do to others. Wasn't Ted Bundy just a version of El Cuco? A shapeshifter with one face for the people he knew and another for the women he killed. The last thing those women saw was his other face, his inside face, the face of El Cuco. There are others. They walk among us. You know they do. They're aliens, monsters, beyond our understanding. Yet you believe in them. You've put some of them away, maybe seen them executed.
He was silent, thinking about this.
Let me ask you a question, she said. Suppose it had been Terry Maitland who killed that child and tore off his flesh and put a branch up inside him. Would he be any less inexplicable than the thing that might be hiding in that cave? Would you be able to say, I understand the darkness and evil that was hiding behind the mask of the boy's athletic coach and good community citizen? I know exactly what made him do it.
No. I've arrested men who have done terrible things, and a woman who drowned her baby daughter in the bathtub, and I've never understood. Most times they don't understand themselves.
No more than I understood why Brady Hartsfield set out to kill himself at a concert and take 1,000 or more innocent children with him. What I'm asking is simple. Believe in this, if only for the next 24 hours. Can you do that?
Will you be able to get some sleep if I say yes?
She nodded, her eyes never leaving him.
Then I believe. For the next 24 hours, at least, El Cuco exists. Whether or not he's in the Marysville hole remains to be seen, but he exists.
Holly exhaled and stood up, hair windblown, suit coat hanging down on one side, shirt untucked. Ralph thought she looked both adorable and horribly fragile. Good. I'm going to bed. He saw her to the door and opened it. As she stepped out, he said, No end to the universe. She looked at him solemnly. That's right. No end to the fracking thing. Good night, Ralph.
The Marysville Hole, July 27th. 1. Jack awoke at 4 in the morning. The wind was blowing outside, blowing hard, and he hurt all over. Not just his neck, but his arms, his legs, his belly, his butt. It felt like a sunburn. He threw back the covers, sat on the edge of the bed, and turned on the bedside lamp, which cast a sallow 60-watt glow. He looked down at himself and saw nothing on his skin, but the pain was there. It was inside.
I'll do what you want, he told the visitor. I'll stop them. I promise.
There was no answer. The visitor either wasn't replying or wasn't there. Not now, at least. But he had been out at that goddamn barn. Just one light, ticklish touch, almost a caress, but it had been enough. Now he was full of poison. Cancer poison. And sitting here in this shitty motel room, long before dawn, he was no longer sure the visitor could take back what he had given him. But what choice did he have? He had to try. If that didn't work, I'll shoot myself. The idea made him feel a little better. It was an option his mother hadn't had. He said it again, more decisively. I'll shoot myself.
No more hangovers. No more driving home at exactly the speed limit, stopping at every light. Not wanting to get pulled over when he knew he'd blow at least a 1, maybe even a 1.2. No more calls from his ex reminding him that he was once more late with her monthly check. As if he didn't know. What would she do if those checks stopped coming? She'd have to go to work. See how the other half lived. Oh, boo-hoo. No more sitting home all day watching Ellen and Judge Judy. What a shame. He dressed and went out. The wind wasn't exactly cold, but it was chilly. It seemed to go right through him. It had been hot when he left Flint City, and he'd never thought of bringing a jacket or a change of clothes or even a toothbrush. "That's you, honey," he could hear the old ball and chain saying. "That's you all over, a day late and a buck short." Cars, pickup trucks, and a few campers were drawn up to the motel building like nursing puppies. Jack went down the covered walkway far enough to make sure the blue SUV belonging to the meddlers was still there. It was. They were all tucked up in their rooms, no doubt dreaming pleasant, pain-free dreams. He entertained a brief fantasy of going room to room and shooting them all. The idea was attractive but ridiculous. He didn't know which rooms they were in, and eventually someone, not necessarily the chief meddler, would start shooting back. This was Texas, after all, where people liked to believe they were still living in the days of cattle drives and gunfighters. Better to wait for them where the visitor said they might come. He could shoot them there and be pretty sure of getting away with it. No one around for miles. If the visitor could take away the poison once the job was done, all would end well. If he couldn't, Jack would suck the end of his service Glock and pull the trigger. Fantasies of his ex waitressing or working in the glove factory for the next 20 years were entertaining, but not the most important consideration. He wasn't going the way his mother had gone, with her skin splitting open every time she tried to move. That was the important consideration. He got in his truck, shivering, and headed for the Marysville hole. The moon sat near the horizon, looking like a cold stone. The shivering became shaking, so bad that he swerved across the broken white line a couple of times. That was okay. All the big rigs either used Highway 190 or the interstate. There was no one on the Rural Star at this ungodly hour except for him. Once the ram's engine was warm, he turned the heater on high, and that was better. The pain in his lower body began to subside. The back of his neck still throbbed like a very bitch, though, and when he rubbed it, his palm came away covered with snowflakes of dead skin. The idea occurred to him that maybe the pain in his neck was just a real, ordinary sunburn, and everything else was in his mind. Psychosomatic, like the old ball and chains bullshit migraines. Could psychosomatic pain actually wake you up out of a sound sleep? He didn't know, but he knew that the visitor who'd been hiding behind the shower curtain in his bedroom had been real, and you didn't want to screw around with someone like that. What you wanted to do with someone like that was exactly what he said. Plus, there was Ralph fucking Anderson, who had always been on his case. Mr. No Opinion, who got him hauled back from his fishing vacation by getting suspended. Which is what Ralphie boy was, and fuck that administrative leave shit. Ralph fucking Anderson was the reason that he, Jack Hoskins, had been out in Canning Township instead of sitting in his little cabin watching DVDs and drinking vodka tonics. As he turned in at the billboard, closed until further notice, a sudden insight electrified him. Ralph fucking Anderson might have sent him out there on purpose. He could have known the visitor would be waiting and what the visitor would do. Ralphie boy had wanted to get rid of him for years, and once you factored that in, all the pieces fell into place.
The logic was undeniable. The only thing Ralphie boy hadn't counted on was being double-crossed by the man with the tattoos. As to how this fuckery would turn out, Jack saw three possibilities. Maybe the visitor could get rid of the poison now coursing through Jack's system. That was number one. If it was psychosomatic, it would eventually go away on its own. That was number two. Or maybe it was real, and the visitor couldn't take it away. That was number three. Mr. No Fucking Opinion was going to be history, no matter which possibility turned out to be the right one. That was a promise Jack made, not to the visitor, but to himself. Anderson was going down, and the others would go with him, clean sweep. Jack Hoskins, American Sniper. He came to the abandoned ticket booth and detoured around the chain. The wind would probably die away once the sun was up and the temperature really started to climb again, but it was still blowing now, sending sheets of dusty grit flying, and that was good. He wouldn't have to worry about the meddlers seeing his tracks. If they came at all, that was. If they don't, can you still fix me up? He asked, not expecting an answer, but one came. Oh, yes, you'll be good to go. Was that a real voice, or only his own? What did it matter?
2. Jack drove past the falling down tourist cabins, wondering why anyone would want to spend good money to stay near what was essentially just a hole in the ground. At least the name of the place was truthful. Did no one have any better places to go? Yosemite? The Grand Canyon? Even the world's largest ball of string would be better than a hole in the ground out here in dry and dusty asshole Texas. He parked beside the service shed as he had on his previous trip, grabbed his flashlight from the glove compartment, then got the Winchester and a box of ammo out of the lockbox. He stuffed his pockets with shells, started for the path, then turned back and shone his light through one of the dusty windows of the shed's garage-type roll-up door, thinking there might be something he could use inside. There wasn't, but what he saw still made him smile. A dust-covered compact car, probably a Honda or a Toyota. On the back window was a decal reading, "My son is a Flint City High School honor student." Poisoned or not, Jack's rudimentary detective skills were intact. His visitor was here, all right. He had driven down from FC in this stolen car. Feeling better, and actually hungry for the first time since the tattooed hand had come creeping around the shower curtain, Jack returned to the truck and rummaged in the glove compartment some more. He eventually unearthed a package of peanut butter crackers and a half a roll of Tums. Not exactly the breakfast of champions, but better than nothing. He started up the trail, munching one of the nabs and carrying the Winnie in his left hand. There was a strap, but if he slung it over his shoulder, it would chafe his neck. Maybe make it bleed. His pockets, heavy with cartridges, swung and bumped against his legs. He halted at the faded Indian sign. Old Chief Wahoo, testifying that Carolyn Allen sucked his redskin cock, struck by a sudden thought. Anyone coming down the byroad leading to the tourist cabins would see his ram parked beside the service shed and wonder what was up with that. He considered going back to move it, then decided he was worrying needlessly. If the meddlers came, they'd park near the main entrance. As soon as they got out to look around, he would open fire from his shooter's perch on top of the bluff, knocking two or maybe even three of them down before they realized what was happening. The others would go scurrying around like chickens in a thunderstorm. He'd get them before they could find cover. There was no need to worry about what they might see from the tourist cabins because Mr. No Opinion and his friends were never going to get out of the parking lot. 3. The path up the bluff was treacherous in the dark, even with the help of the flashlight, and Jack took his time. He had enough problems without falling and breaking something.
By the time he got to his lookout point, the first hesitant light was starting to seep into the sky. He shone his flash on the pitchfork he'd left behind the day before, started to reach for it, then recoiled. He hoped this wasn't an omen of how the rest of his day was going to go, but the situation had its irony, and even in his current situation, Jack could appreciate it. He had brought the pitchfork to guard against snakes, and now one was lying beside and partly on top of it. It was a rattlesnake, and not a little one. This was a real monster. He couldn't shoot it. A bullet might only wound the goddamn thing, in which case it would probably strike at him, and he was wearing sneakers, having neglected to buy boots and tippet. Also, there was the potential for a ricochet that might do him serious damage. He held his rifle by the end of its stock, slowly extending the barrel as far as he could. He got it under the dozing rattler and flipped it high over his shoulder before it could slither away. The ugly bastard landed on the path 20 feet behind him, coiled and began sounding off, a noise like beads being shaken in a dry gourd. Jack snatched up the pitchfork, took a step forward, and jabbed at it. That rattler slithered into a crack between two leaning boulders and was gone. "That's right," Jack said. "And don't come back. This is my place." He lay down and peered through the scope. There was the parking lot, with its ghostly yellow lines. There was the decaying gift shop. There was the boarded-up cave entrance, the sign over it faded but still legible. "Welcome to the Marysville Hole." Nothing to do now but wait. Jack settled in to do it.
4. Nothing before 9 o'clock, Ralph had said, but they were all in the Indian Motel's cafe by 8:15. Ralph, Howie, and Alec ordered steak and eggs. Holly passed on the steak but ordered a 3-egg omelet with ranch fries, and Ralph was gratified to see she ate every bite. She was once more wearing the jacket of her suit over her T-shirt and jeans. "That's going to be hot later on," Ralph said.
"Yes. And it's very wrinkled, but it's got nice big pockets for my stuff. I'm also taking my shoulder bag, although I'll leave it in the car if we have to hike." She leaned forward and dropped her voice. "Sometimes the maids steal in places like this."
Howie covered his mouth, perhaps to stifle a belch, perhaps to hide a smile.
5. They drove to the Bolton place, where they found Yoon and Claude sitting on the front porch steps and drinking coffee. Lovey was in her little side garden, weeding from her wheelchair with her oxygen bottle in her lap, a cigarette in her mouth, and a big straw sun hat clapped on her head.
"All good last night?" Ralph asked.
"Fine," Yoon said. "Wind was a little noisy out back, but once I went to sleep, I slept like a baby." "What about you, Claude? Everything okay?"
"If you mean did it feel like there's someone creeping around again, I didn't. Ma either."
"Well, there might be a reason for that," Alec said. "Cops and Tippett had a home invasion last night. Man of the house heard breaking glass, grabbed his shotgun, scared the guy off. Told the police the intruder had black hair, a goatee, and plenty of tattoos."
Claude was outraged. "I never budged out of my bedroom last night."
"We don't doubt that," Ralph said. "It could be the guy we've been looking for. We're going to Tippett to check it out. If he's gone, and he probably is, we'll fly back to Flint City and try to figure out what to do next.
Although I don't know what more we can do," Howie added. "If he's not hanging around here, and if he's not in Tippett, he could be anywhere."
"No other leads?" Claude asked.
"Not a one," Alec said.
Lovey rolled over to them.
"If you all decide to go home, stop in and see us on your way to the airport. I'll make up some sandwiches from the leftover chicken.
long as you don't mind eating it twice, that is.
We'll do that, Howie said. Thank you both. It's me she'd be thanking you, Claude said. He shook hands with them all around, and Lovey opened her arms to give Holly a hug. Holly looked startled, but allowed it.
You come back now,
Lovey whispered in her ear. I will, Holly replied, hoping it was a promise she would be able to keep. 6. Howie drove with Ralph riding shotgun and the other three in the back seat. The sun was up, and it was going to be another hot one.
Just wondering how the cops in Tippett got in touch with you, Yoon said. I didn't think anyone in authority knew we were down here.
They don't, Alec replied. If this outsider actually exists, we didn't want to raise any suspicions with the Boltons about why we're going in the wrong direction.
Ralph didn't need to be a mind reader to know what Holly was thinking at this moment. Every time you and the others talk about the outsider, it's conditional. Ralph turned around in his seat. Listen to me now. No more ifs or maybes. For today, the outsider does exist. For today, he can read Claude Bolton's mind anytime he wants to. And unless we know differently, he's in the Marysville hole. No more assumptions, just belief. Can you do that? For a moment, no one replied. Then Howie said,
I'm a defense lawyer, son. I can believe anything.
7. They came to the billboard showing the awestruck family holding up their gas lanterns. Howie drove slowly up the cracked asphalt entry road, avoiding the potholes as best he could. The temperature, which had been in the mid-50s when they set out, was now edging into the 70s. It would go higher.
See that knoll up there, Holly pointed. The main cave entrance is in the base of it. Or was, until they plugged it. We should check there first. If he tried to get in that way, there might be some sign.
Fine with me, Yoon said, looking around. Jesus, this is desolate country.
The loss of those boys and the rescue party that went after them was terrible for their families, Holly said. But it was also a disaster for Marysville. The hole was the town's only job provider. A lot of locals left after it closed down.
Howie braked.
That must have been the ticket booth, and I spy a chain across the road. Go around it, Yoon said. Give this baby suspension a workout.
Howie drove around the chain, his seat-belted passengers bouncing up and down.
Okay, folks, we are now officially trespassing on private property.
A coyote broke from cover at their approach and sprinted away, his lean shadow racing beside him. Ralph spotted the remains of wind-eroded tire tracks and assumed that local kids, there had to be at least a few of them left in Marysville, brought their ATVs out here. He was mostly focused on the rocky bluff ahead, site of what had been Marysville's one and only tourist attraction. It's raison d'etre, if you wanted to be fancy about it.
We're all carrying, Yoon said. He was sitting upright in his seat, eyes fixed straight ahead, on alert. Is that correct?
The men answered in the affirmative. Holly Gibney said nothing. 8. From his perch atop the bluff, Jack saw them coming long before they reached the acre of parking lot. He checked his weapon, fully loaded, with one in the pipe. He had placed a flat stone at the edge of the drop. Now he lay at full length with the barrel resting on it. He sighted through the scope, putting the crosshairs on the driver's side of the windshield. A sun flash momentarily blinded him. He winced, drew back, rubbed his eyes until the floating spot was gone, then peered into the scope again. Come on, he thought, stop in the middle of the parking lot. That would be perfect. Stop there and get out. The SUV instead trundled diagonally across the parking lot and stopped in front of the cave's boarded-over entrance. All the doors opened, and five people got out. Four men and one woman. Five little meddlers all in a row. Lovely. Unfortunately, it was a shit shot. The sun in its current position cast the cave's entrance in shadow. Jack might have chanced that. The leaphole scope was damn good. But there was a problem of the SUV now blocking at least three of the five, including Mr. No Opinion. Jack lay with his cheek against the rifle stock, and his pulse beating slow and steady in his chest and throat. He was no longer aware of his throbbing neck. The only thing he cared about was the cluster of meddlers standing below the sign reading, "Welcome to the Marysville Hole." "Come on out of there," he whispered. "Come out and look around a little. You know you want to." He waited for them to do it.
9. The hole's arched entryway was blocked by two dozen wooden planks attached by huge rusty bolts to the cement plug beyond. With such double coverage against unauthorized explorers, there was hardly any need of no trespassing signs, but there were a couple anyway. Plus a few fading spray paint tags left, Ralph presumed, by the same kids who brought their ATVs out here.
"Anyone think this looks tampered with?" Yoon asked.
"Nope," Alex said. "Why they even bothered with the boards is beyond me. You'd need a good charge of dynamite to put a hole in that cement plug."
"Which would probably finish the job the quake started," Howie added.
Holly turned around and pointed over the hood of the SUV. "See that road on the other side of the gift shop? That goes to the Ahiga entrance. Tourists weren't allowed to go into the cave that way, but there are many interesting pictographs."
"And you know this how?" Yoon asked.
"The map they gave out to tourists is still online. Everything is online these days."
"It's called research, amigo," Ralph said. "You should try it sometime."
They got back into the SUV, Howie once more behind the wheel with Ralph riding shotgun. Howie started slowly across the parking lot.
"That road looks pretty crappy," he said.
"You should be okay," Holly said. "There are tourist cabins on the other side of the rise. According to the newspaper stories, the second rescue party used them as a staging area. Plus, there would have been lots of media people and worried relatives once the news got out."
"Not to mention your ordinary garden variety rubberneckers," Yoon said. "They probably..."
"Stop, Howie," Alex said. "Whoa!"
They were a little more than halfway across the parking lot now, the SUV's stubby nose pointing toward the road that went to the cabins, and presumably to the hole's back door. Howie braked.
"What? Maybe we're making this tougher than it has to be. The outsider doesn't necessarily have to be in the cave. He was hiding in a barn out there in Canning Township."
"Meaning?"
"Meaning we should check the gift shop, see if there's signs of a break-in."
"I'll do it," Yoon said. Howie opened the driver's door.
"Why don't we all go?"
10. The meddlers left the boarded-up entrance and returned to the SUV, the stocky, balding guy walking around the hood to get back to the wheel. That gave Jack a clear shot. He laid the crosshairs on the guy's face, took a breath, held it, and tightened down on the trigger. It didn't move. There was a nightmarish moment when he thought something was wrong with the Winchester, then he realized he'd forgotten to release the safety. How stupid could you get? He tried to push it without taking his eye from the scope. His thumb, greasy with sweat, slid off, and by the time he released the safety, the stocky man was in the driver's seat and slamming the door. The others were back in as well.
"Shit," Jack whispered.
Shit, shit, shit! He watched with increasing panic as the SUV started across the parking lot and toward the service road that would take it out of his line of fire. They would crest the first hill, they would see the cabins, they would see the service shed, and they would see his truck parked beside it. Would Ralph Anderson know to whom that truck belonged? Of course he would. If not from the leaping fish decals on the side, then from the bumper sticker, "My other ride is your mom," on the back. You can't let them get up that road. He didn't know if that was the visitor's voice or his own, and didn't care because it was right either way. He had to stop the SUV and two or three high